Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, August 30th, 2012. And a lot of interesting topics to talk about tonight. First of all, I'm going to start off with a listener email. I just thought it was interesting. I was digging through some information before the show, and this popped up, and I thought, well, I'll read this at first because it kind of leads into two of the topics that I plan to talk about tonight, one being, of course, Hurricane Isaac, that really just became a hurricane, just barely. Then the other was Neil Armstrong, the first alleged astronaut on the moon, died this past week. And there's, well, a lot of questions involved in that particular story. So let me start out by reading this email from a listener, Jim. It says, Dear Jim, talking to me, it says, don't know if this would be of interest, but I did a little quick probability workup on Isaac, Hurricane Isaac, and sent it to a friend yesterday. I copied it here for you. Just for fun, I solved the equation for combining two probabilities relating to Hurricane Isaac. What I'm solving for is the probability that a hurricane would hit the exact same city on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which hit New Orleans on August 29th. My assumption, hurricane season is from June 21st to November 30th for the Atlantic Ocean hurricanes. This is 180 days, therefore the probability a hurricane would hit land anywhere on that day is 1 over 180, or 0.0056. This is variable A. I assume very conservatively that there are only 25 points on land a hurricane can hit. This would be 1/25th, this variable being B. And actually, I think, yeah, that's real conservative, because if you look at the width of a hurricane, the entire Gulf Coast, the other entire coast of Florida, and then up the eastern seaboard, I would say that that's, I would put it more like one, about 150 places that you could hit, but I'll use what he used is 25 possible locations where a hurricane could hit. Okay, so anyway, I'll continue with what he says, the equation for combining two probabilities, and then he gives the equation one would use. Said this is easy to solve, and when you plug in the above values for A and B into the equation, you get a combined probability of 0.00025 or 23, or roughly 1 in 5,000. Therefore, the probability that a hurricane would hit the exact same point of land on the same date, and then you could actually combine other probabilities. I used one here in that it was 7 years exactly to the day afterwards. And remember, 7 is a prime number, and our little friends up in the Baal worshippers, let's call them, like prime numbers. They like prime numbers, 11, 7, things like that. So I would add that probability in that it would hit on a prime number year. And there again, that reduces the probability, but I would put it more like 1 in 10,000, 1 in about 12,000 probability that a hurricane would hit the same location on the same date, but, you know, exactly 7 years later, a prime number of years later. But anyway, it's very interesting. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I'll be talking more about Hurricane Isaac here during the show. So I just wanted to lead in with that. And then, as an afterthought, in the same email, this listener says, also, you mentioned on your website, this is a posting I had on my website, that no one really got to interview the astronauts that went to the moon, or allegedly went to the moon, Armstrong, etc., those guys. There was never really any, what you'd call, third-party independent interviews of these people, and then he qualifies this and he says that there was a guy named Bart Sabrell, and I've talked with Bart Sabrell on the phone numerous times just about this particular topic, and I should mention that there has been a great deal Ralph Rene is a guy who was one of the early pioneers on this topic. Bart Sabrell and many others who've done excellent work, the early work on did we go to the moon type of question, trying to dig into that. And some of these people actually started out by doing documentaries on the moon landing and all of a sudden started noticing funny things in the videos and the data. But at any rate, I'm going back to the email of listener Jim. It says that I mentioned on my website that nobody had really interviewed Neil Armstrong. And what I meant there was that there was never any serious, what you'd call scientific questioning of the astronauts who allegedly went to the moon. And, I mean, you would sit down and you would ask a series of questions and you would get them apart in different rooms and then cross-examine to see if they gave the same story. I mean, this would be the scientific way to do it. This is the way you'd do it if you were investigating a criminal activity or a scientific, an experiment. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but back to the email. It says there's a guy named Bart Sabrell who made a video in 2004 where he went around to a number of astronauts from the Apollo program and asked them if they would swear on a Bible that they went to the moon. Interestingly, most of them would not, including Neil Armstrong. Mr. Sabrell was physically assaulted by two of the astronauts. Also, most interestingly, his interview with Alan Bean revealed that Mr. Bean did not think that they made it as far as the Van Allen belt. He then caught himself, but first answers are often true, and you would think something as deadly and important and strong as the radiation belt would be remembered. The name of the video is Astronauts Gone Wild. That's the Bart Sabrell video. And also, I know that the way this guy conducted his interviews was obnoxious, but the answers are telling. Thanks for your great work, and I really enjoy it and have learned a lot. Signed, Jim. And, what I'm saying, too, is there was never what you would call an organized, when the astronauts came back from the moon, they were debriefed by the basically NASA military, you would say. And then let me give my opinion as to what happened with Neil Armstrong. And let's flash back to 1969 during the time of the first astronaut to the moon time era. The situation was the Cold War with Russia. Russia had won in the 1950s to put the first satellite up, Sputnik, and then we sent up a satellite shortly after. I think it was called Telstar, and it was just an aluminum ball which you could bounce radar signals off of. But the Russians had beat us into space, so to speak. So it was a big political thing, a Cold War political issue, that we were claiming we were going to go to the moon. John Kennedy had started the Apollo program, or the whole moon program, starting out with the Mercury program, the Gemini program, and then the Apollo program. And so then we get up, that was about 1963 probably, and so we get up to 1969, and guess who's John Kennedy had been shot by New World Order folks trying to keep him from writing American money, creating American, real American money, and getting rid of the CIA. So, gee, I wonder if the CIA had anything to do with shooting John Kennedy. But at any rate, the whole issue there was that Tricky Dick Nixon was in the White House, and guess who had lost the election to John Kennedy? So the whole world got turned upside down. And anyway, here we are at the Cold War, and NASA's under the gun to make this succeed at all costs. So here is, you know, given those conditions, and those conditions only, obviously to me what happened is that guys like Neil Armstrong and the real astronauts were set aside, and they knew they were being set aside so that they'd come down in a nice fresh space capsule and would be, you know, picked up in the ocean, and everybody, it would be 100% success. And they, you know, they probably told Neil Armstrong, somebody else is going to the moon. Somebody else is going to land on the moon, and they're doing it for their country. They'll never be famous, but you're going to be the one that's going to get credit for this. And so Neil Armstrong probably thought somebody had gone to the moon in his stead, and that he was going to be the hero, and that was the plan all along, and never imagining that nobody ever went to the moon. And so the, you know, this is the way the Intel operations work. They would not want to let those three astronauts think that someone did not go to the moon, but they were set aside so that, and then here's the scenario that I see panning out, that the space capsule, the Apollo space capsule, was put into a transport plane, basically flown up to high altitude and then dropped out the back end of a transport plane, the parachutes open, and then the chase plane sees it and comes up on it. It falls in the ocean, and the rest is history. A successful shot to the moon. And so the point is that that's what I think happens. And so Armstrong probably thought that somebody went to the moon, that he knew that he didn't, because he had to be put aside for the safety of the mission, for the welfare of the Cold War in the good old United States. And that's really what I see happening. And, of course, other people have stated this, bits and pieces of that, in various ways. So I remember I was on Art Bell show as a guest back in the 90s, I believe. Art and I did a series of Christmas specials for a number of years. Every year I was a guest with Art Bell, and we did a Christmas special, and I was doing one particular year. The show topic was the Russian space program, and something I happen to know quite a bit about. And so I was discussing the space program, and of course, naturally it came up that did the U.S. go to the moon? And the way it came up was somebody sent in, I think it was kind of like a trick question, trying to make me say something stupid on the air. And that the medical doctors of the NASA program had said that, in fact, going to the moon and passing through the Van Allen belts was not a problem. It was not an issue. And so that therefore somewhat proving that NASA went to the moon and the Van Allen belts were not a problem. Well, it just so happened that I had been familiar with that particular document produced by a government doctor, and I mentioned it on the air. I jumped right on it, and I said, look, that doctor was given instructions that if this were the radiation level of the Van Allen belts, would there be a danger? And based on that, he made his decision. It was not at all based on realistic measurements of radiation in the Van Allen belts. He was given, as many times the lies come out of government, he was given an assignment. He was given an assignment to make a decision based on a predetermined amount of radiation coming off the astronauts would be exposed to in the Van Allen belts, and he made the determination that there would not be a problem from the Van Allen belts. Well, it was a totally bogus report, and I immediately called Art on that on the air, and I said, that is a bogus report. The doctor was given predetermined amounts of radiation that were far under anything realistic for the Van Allen belts, and I said that was a phonied up document by the government to try and prove or make a statement that the Van Allen belts pose no threat to the astronauts. Okay. So at any rate, at that point, Art said that was interesting, because Art had a habit of throwing people off the air if they disagreed with the Apollo program, that the saying that the astronauts didn't go to the moon. But he did not throw me off the air because I supported what I said with facts. And so then Art came up and he said, you know, I interviewed, and I forget which one of the astronauts he interviewed, one of the three original astronauts that allegedly went to the moon. He said, you know, I interviewed that guy once, and he said, I asked him the question. He said, when you were on the moon, and this is, remember, one of the first three astronauts to allegedly reach the moon. He said, when you were on the moon and you were looking around and you saw Earth there, he said, what did you think? What was going through your mind? What was your main thought that you remember? And he said, the guy said, I don't remember. And it was just, I don't remember. It was like when some major event was happening, like, let's say 9-1-1, a major event that in everybody's lives, whether you think it was planned or government operated or Arabs or whatever, everybody knows what they were doing, where they were, what they were thinking at the time when they first discovered that planes had hit the Twin Towers of New York and all of this. Where were you and what were you thinking? Or like they say, the power outage in New York or some other major worldwide event. You knew where you were. You could tell anybody today. You could tell anybody what you were thinking at the time. It was registered in your brain. And here you got an astronaut that's highly trained, highly intelligent, ex-Navy Air Force pilot, trained to be astute on all subjects, goes to the moon, and a talk show host asks him a simple question. What were you thinking at the time when you realized you were on the moon and you're looking back at Earth, and there you are on the moon, and the guy goes, I don't remember. It's like... Give me a break. I don't remember. Anyway, so Neil Armstrong taking any secrets he's had to the grave. And my personal opinion, and I've said this, I'll just repeat it, I highly doubt that NASA ever went to the moon on any of the flights. They dismantled the Saturn program as soon as they stopped the flights in the mid-1970s. They canceled the last three moon flights and then dismantled the whole Saturn rocket program. But here's my statement, that there has never been any third-party independent verification of the NASA claim that they sent astronauts to the moon and retrieved them, brought them back safely numerous times. There, and including the first time, there is no third-party independent verification of any of this. So, and given all of the other shady stuff that has surrounded that whole program, I'd put a very high dubious value on, or very high, what would you call it, a high probability that they did not ever make it there. And additionally, when I was working with some Russian scientists in the middle of the 1990s, the general opinion, and this is coming back from top-level Russian scientists, that the general opinion of all Russian scientists was that NASA never went to the moon, and they thought it was pretty humorous that the American public bought it hook, line, and sinker and were so enamored with NASA for going to the moon when they knew that NASA never had the technology to land, to take off, all of those issues. I gave a show one night on a very simple fact that I came up with. Okay, the lunar lander supposedly goes down, lands on the moon. Now it's sitting on the moon, and it's going to be at somewhat of an angle. It's not going to be perfectly horizontal, vertical, you know, etc. And so, okay, now there's the orbiter that's still orbiting the moon. That's in a very set orbit. And remember, there's no windows in these things on the docking side. So the question is, Okay, that lunar module now has to blast off. It has a single, mind you, central rocket in the bottom, and that has to blast off and come back and dock with the orbiting lunar orbiting module that's still orbiting, and then to bring everybody back home. Well, there's a little problem here, folks, in that once you take off, they didn't have any ability or any way of modifying that orbit of the lunar module going off of the moon to get back to exactly the orbit of the lunar the module that was still orbiting the moon, which carried one guy who did not go down to the moon. And so that's a big problem to that part where you leave the moon. You got to hook up to something that's in orbit, that's spinning around the moon in an orbit, and going pretty fast, by the way. And you and when you take off and your whole lunar rig is at a slight angle, you're going to take off at a slight angle away from that original orbit. Besides, when they're coming down, they're doing all kinds of maneuvering. And the whole point is that when they try and get back off the moon and hook up with the orbiting lunar orbiter, then it's really, really difficult. And that'd be something that'd be very difficult today. If you understand that piece of connecting spacecraft, it's not just a simple connecting spacecraft like in the Gemini program. You first have to get there. Okay, so at any rate, I'm going to stop talking about that. The whole moon program, and I know there's a lot of people, the most recent thing on the internet is speeding up the lunar rover. That's the little car that they drove around the moon. That you speed it up, you do it two times a speed up, and it looks like the car driving around the U.S. desert, and that's probably what it was, or a mock-up in a laboratory in cinematography laboratory down in the American Southwest. NASA. The point is that there's a high number of people, high percentage of people that don't believe NASA ever went to the moon. And so NASA has a credibility problem, whether they like it or not. Okay, I'm going to go on to a couple other topics, and then I'm going to talk about the hurricane, the Isaac. There's some interesting twists on that. There's an issue going on right now in the Arctic Sea. The Arctic Sea extent, this is the North Pole ice cap. The ice extent is at its lowest in history, and it's bottoming out much lower than it ever was before. So the lowest years on record were 2007, 2011 was the second lowest, and 2008 was the third lowest, and then now 2012, we are heading down to break all of those records, the extent of the sea ice. And understand that I have said before that we don't have a freshwater problem on Earth. We have a freshwater management problem on Earth. And the head of countries, the head of nations are too busy trying to set up terrorism and counterterrorism and things like that rather than deal with the issues that are giant on this planet, including the issue of water. The issue of water on this planet, and harvesting this water. But the government scientists who deal with this are too happy to sit in their little offices and get their government paycheck and fill out graphs. That's all nice. But how many of them are jumping up and pounding on the door of government saying, you've got to harvest this water, we've got to move this water? And same with Greenland and the same with the Antarctic. There's just rivers of water pouring into the ocean, rivers of fresh water, beautiful fresh water flowing into the ocean and going completely to waste. There should be ships there loading up with this valuable earth resource and bringing it up to areas where there's need of water, making man-made freshwater lakes. And so at any rate, that's just reporting that. But remember that, as I mentioned in my weather book and my other books, that we are in a global warming due to the fact that we are coming out of an ice age. We were in an ice age, not because Earth just jumped up and decided to do it all by itself one day, but because we had a global Earth-wide disaster in that we passed through a comet tail for a long time. When the Venus event occurred, we passed through a comet tail. It glaciated the Earth. We had a lot of water influx. The ocean levels rose a couple hundred feet. And a lot of that water was glaciated because the sun was blocked out. And remember, we had a pole shift. There was about a 35-degree shift of the North Pole, the old North Pole being in the center of the old Laurentian ice cap, which was about now where the current Canadian province of Ontario, just north of the state of Wisconsin and Michigan, a number of maybe 500 miles north of there. That's where the old North Pole was, the North Celestial Pole. And that shifted, and all of a sudden the Siberian area, which was much more tropical at the time, or temperate for sure, with herds of mastodons ranging, and that was shifted up, and those animals were buried in the permafrost, buried up 20 feet deep in this and froze to death with fresh flowers and fresh plants in their mouths, undigested. And so at any rate, the issue of global warming, yes, we are warming up, but it's just the natural result of Earth warming up. The concept that this is due to greenhouse effect and global warming, I've repeated this, that your car produces thousands and thousands of times more heat than the greenhouse effect or global warming would ever dream of producing. But scientists never talk about that. It's like driving your car in the heat coming off that heat engine is like a sledgehammer, okay, in terms of size. The greenhouse effect, which is really non-existent, is like a feather, the lightest, softest, downy feather, just gently tapping something. That's the comparison of the amount of heat being generated by these two processes. Yet nobody, no scientist, no government scientist ever talks about the fact that we are using vast amounts of oxygen from the atmosphere, and the fact that the quality of air is going down because we're simply using oxygen, and that the amount of heat coming off your engine right now is thousands, a hundred thousands, millions of times more than any greenhouse effect would ever have, yet nobody talks about that. It's more of the absurd fairy tale science coming out of the standard science community. Okay, so let me just make sure I've talked. Oh, I just wanted to make a comment about last week's show. I really get somewhat involved in talking about the issue of Hale-Bopp. And if you didn't hear last week's show, make sure you listen to it. It's a must-listen show. And why do I talk about this? First of all, to just show you all of the ins and outs of what happened during that time, all of the misinformation, the hiding of information by NASA, the lies, the double lies, the covering information, and how it relates to issues like the Planet X topic. And also that helps prepare people. If that's what they did then, just imagine if there's something major coming into the solar system, the amount of misinformation, the amount of just total lies that would be presented to the public to prevent the public from really knowing the truth. So that's why I do shows like last week. I do that because it helps you understand, it helps you prepare for what's coming down the road if a Planet X topic type of object ever would come into the solar system. All of the misinformation, all of the lies, all of the NASA scientists out there giving some kind of story, harassing people that are trying to get a real story to the public, and then also all of the crazies that are created by the government to sidetrack the public. And so it's a real zoo out there. All of the information that's presented and that the public has to sift through, and the vast majority of the public will just be clueless. They're just not going to have an idea at all of what possibly might be going on in a case like that. So at any rate, that last week's show is a must listen. And okay, on to the next topic. I want to talk about Hurricane Isaac, and I hope I have time at the end of this show. I want to give a little bit of commentary on Mars, on the loss of its atmosphere and the fact that it's regaining atmosphere. The fact that Mars someday will be a water planet again. How does that happen? How is it regaining atmosphere? And where did its atmosphere go? Okay, so I hope I get time to get to that topic. But first, certainly Hurricane Isaac deserves some commentary. My opinion of Hurricane Isaac very early on in its history was that it was a manipulated storm. My clue was that it was barely past the southern tip of Florida, starting to go up, and everybody started saying, wow, this is just like Katrina. This could go to New Orleans. This could be a Category 5 hurricane hitting New Orleans. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of places this thing could go, this storm could go. And why is everybody talking about Katrina and comparing it to Katrina? And they're saying all the characteristics of this storm are like Katrina. And I'm going, what do you mean? It's just a hurricane coming through the Gulf. And it wasn't even a Category 1 hurricane. It was a tropical storm. It still had 65-mile-an-hour winds. What are these people talking about? And I thought, uh-oh, they're sending this baby into New Orleans, and they're going to drag it in there just like putting a ring in a bull's nose and leading it right up there. And, of course, that's directly where it hit. It hit Crescent City, which is right there at New Orleans. And so that's why I read that listener email at the beginning, because, number one, it shows that people out there are really tuned to what's going on. And that I believe, my work, a lot of what I'm doing, this radio show, people are really tuned to what is going on. But I think that says it all, too, that people don't believe the government or the news story for one second. It's just too much to believe, too ridiculous. And I like that listener's analysis. What's the probability that on the same day, 7 years later, that a hurricane is going to hit the same place? And here is what happened, because I watched them. Once I got a clue that, okay, this is what's going on with this tropical storm Isaac, and they're going to try and pump this baby up and move it into New Orleans, they tried their hardest to get that thing up to Category 5. They had the laser satellites pumping into that, and you could see the front edges on that, and they were moving it slow so it would pump up more energy, and had plenty more time to build up energy. And they couldn't get it up more than just barely above Cat 1. And the reason was is because there wasn't enough energy in our region of the solar system at the time. There was another storm taking energy over in the Pacific, and so there just wasn't enough energy to get Hurricane or Tropical Storm Isaac up to anything more than a basic Cat 1. They wanted that baby at Cat 5 and ripping into New Orleans on the 7th anniversary of Katrina. And that delayed. They had to delay it a couple of days to try and get the energy up. And so it was destined to be there on the 7th anniversary of Katrina. But, like I say, they had to leave it set out to sea longer, so that they had to leave it set out at sea longer to try and pump up the energy. But at any rate, that's my opinion of that that particular storm. Also, like I said, the idea that it's 7 years exactly to the date that Katrina hit. In all of these comparisons to Katrina, I thought it was just a little bit much. And now, of course, it's doing a lot of damage, the tropical storm. It didn't last as a hurricane for very long, but it had picked up plenty of water. And, of course, that water going into the New Orleans area and north is now doing a lot of flooding. I saw one report that the Mississippi River actually backed up because of the amount of water falling. The river actually flowed northwards, and so now they're trying to alleviate the water damage down in that area of the south. And just as easily as these storms can be manipulated to do damage, they could be eliminated, dragged off, and dumped in areas where they would do little harm. But at any rate, the plan for doing that was offered for free to the military, to the Navy, to the Air Force, and nobody wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Nobody wanted to learn how to disseminate hurricanes. But they certainly learned how to manipulate them to drag the power up and to use them for damage. That just shows you where the good people running this country and I'm not sure if I'm sure little Obama doesn't know anything about this. They keep people like that pretty much in the dark. He's just a figurehead. He doesn't really know anything or do anything. So people who think that Obama, Romney has to be elected or get rid of Obama, you have to understand those people don't do anything. They don't decide anything. Obama, just like Romney, reads off of cue cards. He says what he's told to say, both of them. They work for the same troops, the same party, the same bankers. So at any rate, let me see if I have anything else in my notes about Isaac. Well, that's pretty much it. I just thought it was a manipulated storm. It was very strange, all the early hype on that storm. Let me get off now to the topic, main science topic of the night, talking about Mars and the loss of atmosphere regarding Mars. Now, I've talked before, and of course, this is something that came out of Velikovsky's studies when he was looking at calendars. The fact that Mars had a different orbit back then, but in the pre-Venus comet days, Mars had a different orbit. It came much closer to Earth in its orbit. And in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, I talk about the ability of Earthlings to travel to Mars, and Mars was like an island planet where there was traffic back and forth that period where they came close together. If you timed it just right, it wouldn't be much more difficult than just going to the moon. But the difference is that Mars was a water planet. So back in the days, the pre-catastrophe days when there was high technology, and I've also said that the technology that's used today to go into space with all the computers and all of that, none of that is necessary. That you could go into space just like driving a car. It would be very easy to go into space. But remember that NASA, the whole point of NASA, is to prevent you from going into space and to make it look so difficult that only a major government program could possibly have enough resources to go into space. But the story was that the ancients realized that Mars was a water planet just like Earth. And they give records of it, the comet coming by, the electrical extension coming out from the comet. And as I talk about this in the weather book. I talk about this in my books, all of my books where I discuss the issue of Mars, that the nucleus of Venus was larger than Mars. The nucleus of Venus, the comet, was smaller than Earth. So the surface gravity, as that came by Mars, the surface gravity, as the electrical connections started to become made, as the atmosphere of Mars became ionized, basically it was the planet or the comet nucleus that had the greater surface gravity that would win the tug of war. So it basically pulled the atmosphere off of Mars, leaving Mars as the dusty red planet that we see today. And no, by the way, I don't think that the Mars rover that's up there has anything to do with the real scientific packages that have been put up on Mars. So, but at any rate, that's what happened to the oceans of Mars. They were lifted off in a single catastrophic night. And by the way, there is history that goes back to indicate that that's where Baal lived. That Baal, the guy, not an exactly a nice guy, was from Mars. And when they split from Mars, they came here and basically started they landed somewhere in the middle of Europe and began, after the disaster that eventually befell Earth, started the banking community. And that's one of the evils that they carried with them, was the manipulation and control of mankind through banking, the wars, taxation, and banking as a control of man. Credit, the way to rob the labors of people and put it and control people, and that's exactly what's going on today. So at any rate, if you hear some noise in the background, I'm not exactly in my studio tonight. I'm doing this show remotely, so you may hear some road noise. You may hear some motorcycles that just came by. So at any rate, sometimes I'm not exactly in my studio. But be that as it may, okay, now talking about Mars regaining its atmosphere and oceans. How could a planet, after losing its oceans and atmosphere, start to regain it? And that's exactly what's going on with Mars. Remember, all of the planets are acting as comets. We're constantly in water. I talked about like comet-like, they tap into the atmosphere, and the Duluth storm, the water come from the storm that popped into the plains of the ocean, developing the state of Duluth as the time cell develop at night. Well, where is all this water coming from? And then where does it go? Well, a lot of that water, remember that in one storm, in terms of the overall quantity of water on Earth, it's not very much. But when you drop it all on a city at once, 10 inches of rain is a lot of water. But it's not enough to notice on a worldwide scale. And a lot of that water ends up moving through the hydrological cycles up to the poles and is dumped there and builds up over year after year after year. So a lot of that water moves up in our atmosphere and ends up at the North and South Pole. Going back to Mars, okay, Mars now is a comet, too. It's acting just like a comet. Jupiter, Saturn, all of the planets have this comet-like characteristic. It's discharging the solar capacitor, and part of that discharge is the influx of ions and the ionized molecules that are in outer space. I talked about this a couple weeks ago. Some listener said, well, where does the water come from? I said, well, the hydrogen and oxygen ionized come in separately, and then at some point when the electric field is pulling this in, they combine and form water, and then that comes in and drops into Earth's atmosphere in very localized areas. And, of course, this has been observed by satellites. This has been observed. But anyway, so Mars is slowly regaining its atmosphere. I forget which one of the Mars landers, it was back, I believe, in the 1980s. the U.S. sent a probe to Mars. It landed. It measured the extent of the atmosphere of Mars. Okay, that gives you a value of the density, the composition of the Martian atmosphere. 10 years later, or 8 years later, another probe came, and they were using a balloon landing, a balloon breaking technique, and they were using the data that was originally gathered by the first probe. And what they realized is the extent of Mars's atmosphere, the atmosphere of Mars, had doubled. In that eight-year period, the atmosphere of Mars had doubled in extent, which is quite an amazing feat for a planet. But, of course, NASA would never talk about that or come up with any kind of explanation. They did publish the result, which somewhat surprised me. But at any rate, Mars was gaining atmosphere. Where exactly was it coming from? Well, Mars is a comet. It's bringing in atmosphere. So that brings up the question, how long will it be until Mars is a water planet again? Well, let's go out in geological terms. Let's say 1 million years. Could Mars become a water planet in 1 million years if it's doubling its atmosphere every 8 years? 1 million years is a long time. That would give it enough time. And remember, Mars has sufficient gravity to maintain the gas and water once it gets there. So the Mars would have a, let's say 1 million years or 10 million years, you know, not a long time geologically. Mars could potentially become a water planet again. But how could you speed this process up? And by the way, I should mention, I forgot to mention this on a previous show when talking about all of the equipment that NASA is putting on planets, on the moon, especially a planet like Mars that has an atmosphere. They do not decontaminate these spacecraft before they leave Earth. So what's going on? They are contaminating the planets. If you look throughout the history of man, if you look throughout the history of Earth, and all the damage that has been done by traders, by travelers, by people simply moving from one place to the other in the natural progression of history, and moving disease, moving bugs, moving plants, moving who knows what all from one spot on Earth to another, and destroying ecosystems, etc. And that's going on the planets. By the time there's the incredible amount of space junk floating around Earth, tens and tens of thousands of pieces of junk just floating around Earth, some of them big, some of them the size of a nut. But if you get hit by a nut moving 17,000 miles an hour, it's enough to blow your spacecraft apart. And so but the pollution of outer space, and now the pollution of other planets going unchecked, this is not good science. It's not good science at all. But anyway, back to the issue of Mars. How could you speed up the process of making Mars into a water planet? What could you do? Well, what could you do to speed up the process of the comet being made? Okay, well, you could let out a tether. A tether being, say, a long, thin, very micro-thin carbon fiber moving out from the upper atmosphere of Mars. And it would go out in because of the centrifugal force of Mars moving around the sun in its orbit. Mars is moving around, and so if you trailed out a long tether out behind Mars, it would tend to move out away from Mars, and you could enhance the electrical discharge. You could, in effect, cause Mars to become more of a comet than what it naturally is. and this would cause Mars to adopt water very quickly. And so Mars could become a water planet much more quickly. It's a it's my version of a process called terraforming, where you take planets that need something, they need some additional element or item, and create a process, a mega process, a planetary or solar system sized process to enhance some attribute. And so that's exactly what you would do. You would enhance the electrical discharge. It would be hard to do with lasers. Lasers would be one possible method. But remember, there's no gas, there's no dense gas in outer space. So the laser would basically pass through the majority of outer space and really not affect anything. If you wanted to create a discharge in Earth's atmosphere, which is a dielectric, you would pass a laser beam through it, and that would basically ionize that path and it'll cause a very good conductive path for electrical current to flow. So at any rate, the point in outer space is there is no conductive dielectric, and so how would you do that? How would you cause a large electrical discharge to form in outer space? And so you would basically use a tether. And how would this work? Well, on the space shuttle program, there was a tether program that was run out of one of the private space development science teams out of La Jolla. This is out in La Jolla, California. And so anyway, their idea was to take a long tether and let it out the window or the bay of the shuttle. And I told them, I knew these scientists, I told them that they should not do that because they're going to discharge the local capacitor and it would be very dangerous to the shuttle and the crew members. Well, they didn't listen. They went ahead and did it, and the tether, they were going to let it out a couple kilometers, maybe I forget how far, but that's quite a long ways. They're going to let it out and let it drag through Earth's magnetic field and create electricity, basically, was the plan. And that would be a way of generating electricity. And I said, well, no, don't do that, because what you're doing is you're interrupting the local electric batteries. You're going to tap into those, and the discharge is going to, you're going to French fry the space shuttle doing this. Well, of course, nobody at NASA believes this, that such things exist. So they started letting their tether out the space shuttle, and the explosion just about blew one of the bay doors off the shuttle. It shut down all of their computers and French fried them. They were lucky enough to have one backup computer they could program and brought the shuttle in safely for a landing. But basically, yeah, they just about blew the shuttle apart, and the tether was only out maybe a few hundred feet or a few hundred yards at most when this happened. So at any rate, that's just, I talk about this too in the latest book, The Diamond Principle. I talk about one of the passive propulsion systems that could be used to spirit spacecraft away from Earth and out into free space away from Earth in a program designed to put large populations of people into orbit. But at any rate, the plan for Mars then would be to take a tether, let it out on the backside of the planet, and let centrifugal force pull it out, and connect it then physically into the surface of Mars, and then let that discharge, enhance the discharge. I suppose you'd have to have a cord that was extremely long, possibly 100,000 kilometers. Where would you get that much carbon? Well, you could get it from outer space. There's a lot of carbon in the region around Mars. And so along with terraforming, I also talk in the Diamond Principle about the fact that once you're out in space, you need to collect the materials for your operations. You have to collect that in outer space. You can't ship everything up into space from Earth. It's extremely costly. It's you only can ship up a certain amount because of the high gravity of Earth. But by using the comet principle, the idea that you can collect ions in outer space and separate them, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, all of those atoms, sulfur, etc., all of those atoms very freely available in outer space, you could collect enough carbon to build your carbon tether in outer space. And, of course, that's something that you would have to do. You would have to develop these processes as part of any spacefaring activity, because you're not always going to have that umbilical cord to Earth. And, of course, the reason people in engineering and in government in the United States and in NASA want this idea, that to maintain this idea that everything has to be shipped up from Earth, because it's big business. It's big bucks. NASA and space is a big business. And to create a device that you can get all of these materials for free out in outer space, that's not exactly what you'd call a welcome concept in the space, in the aerospace industry. Nor is it a very popular concept to build spacecraft with millions of people on it and send them off to be autonomous, moving around the solar system to preserve the human race. That's not exactly a popular idea. I mean, they don't even like groups going off into Guyana or other places becoming independent of the banking system. They fear that. It's one of the top fears on the list of the bankers, and that's because they once people become independent, then other people see, hey, those people are prospering. They're not strapped to all of these interest payments and et cetera. So at any rate, that's a little bit of commentary on Mars. I just want to remind people that the new calendar is out there. It's really, really what I would call an essential device. And if you, it's $39.95. It's available on the webpage, jmccsci.com. And I was surprised with the success of this device, that it really is an amazing device. It allows you to rebuild very easily the calendar and a timepiece. Go to jmccsci.com. And I think I'm running out of time here. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.